Welcome to Heritage Radio Network on tour, broadcasting live from Feast, Portland. I'm Dana Cowan, and before we kick things off, I'd like to thank Travel Portland, Stream PDX, and the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage of Feast possible. Right now, I'm joined by Reed Asil. Did I pronounce it correctly?
Reem.
Reem. Yeah. Sorry, I said Reed, didn't I? Reem Asil. And she has an incredible burgeoning business in Oakland, Reems, California, Defna. Did I?
Diaphah.
Gosh, yeah. Wow. Yes. And an Arab bakery. So I am going to start with a quote. It's something that I heard you say, and you said that revolutions are born in cafes and bakeries, and that you wanted to create a safe space for those conversations. And I feel like that notion of being a revolutionary is just core to who you are, and it stretches way back to the work that you have done, and it also stretches forward to the work that you will do. So can you tell me a little bit about some of your thoughts around the bakery that you have and the restaurants that you have as a meeting place, and how they came to be?
Yeah. So it's a very, in some ways, a very personal sort of homecoming for me, because as someone who has grown up in this country as a child of immigrants, I've never quite felt a place that felt like home. And when I moved to the Bay Area 15 years ago and started organizing in communities to find a voice, whether it be on the job or in their neighborhoods around decisions that were impacting their lives, I felt like the communities I was working with also felt like that sort of lack of groundedness, of instability, and, you know, as we know, sort of in this era and in terms of like our administration, like that is becoming more and more the reality, that like people don't feel a sense of home. And so I was yearning for that for a long time. And I think when I went to, in 2010, when I was sort of on this sort of crossroads of what did I want to do? What is my purpose? Seeing in the Arab world how these food spaces were a central place for people to feel that groundedness and to feel that sense of home despite the political turmoil around them, I just like fell in love with that. And I really wanted to, I felt like I had this aha moment, like Oakland needs that. The Bay Area needs that. Like that was the missing piece in my organizing work, that sort of transformative work, where you could really find spaces of sanctuary. And so I became really committed to recreating that space that I saw when I went and visited.
So I guess what's interesting to me about that is that I thought, you know, from a lot of the work that you've done, that yes, it would be a place of sanctuary, but that in fact it was a place of fomenting ideas and pushing forward new ideas.
Yes.
Is it a balance between those two things?
It's a balance. I mean, I think that what I want people to feel like when they walk in my space is that they can be who they are. You know, they don't have to fear all the things outside those doors. And if you're coming as you are, sometimes that's not necessarily comfortable, you know? And I think that a lot of times, particularly I think for marginalized communities of color that are facing so much backlash, racism, homophobia, sexism, all the things
all
in their
things.
Regular life, you know, like to be able to actually like not have to censor themselves out in the real world, and to be who they are, you know, invites those sort of uncomfortable conversations around privilege and power and all these things. So I welcome that in my space, and I think it's a place that people really appreciate. But I think we do it in a very organic way, in the sense that, Arab hospitality, like at its core, is really about sort of being welcoming to anybody and everybody. And, to being able to tell our story and to invite you and to do it through the senses, right? We like to feed people. That's how we show our hospitality. And so I think that sort of building that trust with the people that come into our doors kind of shifts people's maybe it could be a slight shift, but mm-hmm. it shifts their thinking about who Arabs are or, mm-hmm. you know, like what, because all they get bombarded with is what the mainstream talks about. And maybe when they walk outside those doors, they might think of things a little bit differently.
And do you
but
think-
then also of like who, how they treat, you know, one another. We hope to model the world that we want to see rather than the world that is out there. So that's the revolution internally.
That is a revolution, actually.
Yeah, you know, change the way you eat.
Right. And so let's talk about your food, which yeah. just looking at all of the pictures and, you know, watching you make it in videos, it's so delicious. And one of your goals is to, instead of people just broad brushing Middle Eastern food,
yes.
to actually break it down.
Yes.
And I was hoping that you could just talk about some of those signature dishes of yours and, you know, where they come from and how you yeah. learned them. And
yeah, so my food, I would describe it as really an embodiment of me because I call it Arab street food made with California love. And that really is central to who I am. It's really honoring the place I came from, but then honoring the place I'm in. And so really taking traditional flavors from the Levant, which is where my family is from. My mom is Palestinian, my dad is Syrian, but my mom grew up in Beirut. And so it's this amazing mix of things, right? And then, but then also they're, you know, first generation immigrated to the US and sort of taking the context of where they lived and that definitely affected the food that I grew up with. And so it's all of those things and then wrapped up into this place that I love now, living in California and using those ingredients, so that sort of bounty of California ingredients and merging them. And so our signature dish is a street food called the manouche, which is a fresh baked flatbread. It's our sort of version of the pizza, I guess. It's sort of the what you see people walking on the street eating. It can be eaten any way you'd like, really, open-faced and sharing with friends, or wrapped and on the go, sort of part of people's daily routines. And I grew up on this food. It's something I sort of took for granted until I was an adult. And I was like, why isn't this the trend? little did I know. I remember when I decided, okay, I want to have a bakery business and the manouche would be sort of the central. And my mom would tell me, oh, the Americans, they're not ready for za'atar. But
she was wrong.
She was wrong.
Right? You don't always listen to your mother.
Yeah.
In fact.
And so then that became sort of the place where I could sort of start with the traditional flavors, but then dream, because you can put anything and everything on a manouche. So
you were talking about the restaurant being a place that you can be yourself. And I think that's particularly poignant to you, because when you were growing up, you didn't necessarily feel the ability to completely be yourself. You were growing up in a super white suburb of Boston.
Yes.
You know, is there a memory that brings that into focus completely, like, you know, that sense of being an outsider?
I mean, always. And I think food was like definitely a marker. It's funny because food is like a source of pain and healing for me. And so when I came to food, it was really sort of healing all these, the accumulation of racism and sort of being other and outsider that I felt over the years. But
it was a burden to put on something that you put in your mouth. It's kind of amazing.
It's really crazy, like, yeah. how you carry these memories in the food. And the fact that, you know, the story behind food and, like, the fact that a lot of the dishes that I'm trying to recreate, you know, whether it's through Reims or Diafa, is like food that we can no longer cook in Gaza, in Syria, you know, because of the conditions that are there.
You can't cook it to
keep it alive.
You can't cook it because?
Because of climate change, because of war, because of colonization, the occupation. It's, you know, all these things. So these dishes are like literally dying. And so to be able to recreate those dishes and keep the story and the memory alive is a very healing place for me, because it's like a forgotten memory of my own roots that I'm trying to, I'm every day discovering, you know, through the food.
I didn't know it was that extreme.
Yeah.
And so I know that notion of capturing history and bringing it forward and sharing your identity, that's important, but how much more powerful and important.
It's like layers.
If it's actually, you know, dying.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like layers. I mean, it's beyond just me sort of being the kid who was the outsider, but like more to the, like, the history of my people. And but there also in that story, there's like a history of our resilience, like how we've been able to move to different places and recreate our foods and adapt to the, you know, it's like there's just like this world to be discovered in terms of the flavors and the food. So I'm really excited to be able to dive into that.
It's also interesting, the adaptation, right? I mean, resilience and adaptation are related notions.
Yeah.
So you are bringing things back that would have died, but you're also adapting them to a place that will make them live longer.
Exactly.
And also it's impossible to not adapt because
and
you
have
really
the ingredients. And we're really flexible. Like, I really feel like you know, my cuisine is very flexible in that way. There's not hard, rigid rules. Like, even the same dishes, when you go from country to country in the Middle East, like, they're different because people adapt, you know? Like, there's not this rigidity around it. So, like, I think it lends itself to creativity. And even if you go to Lebanon today, like, there is a renaissance of these dishes that used to be like a certain way, and people are doing them differently. And I think that that's really cool. Like, food is meant to evolve.
Right. Food is living. But we were talking about your childhood, that it was, you know, both painful and healing.
It was.
But this,
I was going to say, like, I think, but food was a way to connect to people too. I remember, like, coming home and like crying to my mom because, like, you know, our world studies history was like showing Arabs and like these like really sort of racialized stereotypes and how we, you know, how we eat our food and how, you know, and it was hard, you know. And then during Ramadan, when we were fasting and not eating, and then, you know, my mom would pack us like, you know, za'atar and like all these things that like looked gross to the kids, you know. So I remember my mom playing a really integral role of actually coming in and like guest speaking in my classes when we would have, which was kind of mortifying,
but she
would like bring, you know, fresh baked baklava and ma'mul, which is like a traditional semolina cookie that we enjoy in the holidays. And I was like the coolest kid in the class for those moments, and that felt really amazing to me. That like,
did you find your mother bold food. For that? I mean, did you think like, how brave she must, brave, it's a bad word, but how strong she must have been, because she knew. I mean, she knew what you were going through, and she knew there were a bunch of ignorant, I'm not going to say intolerant, but like ignorant kids in that class. Do you think she did it like forcefully, intentionally?
She did. I think my mom is really, and it's funny now, 30 years later, is like, I understand where I get that, you know, that where I get that from is
what's
like
that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like that sort of steadfastness, you know, like you're always going to survive, and you're always going to be proud of who you are, and you should never shy away from that. Like, I got that from my mom. And I remember, you know, to the extent she couldn't, you know, protect us all the time, but she really tried everything she could to make us feel like, that we belonged, you know, and the culture was very strong in our home. And even if it wasn't strong in school or in sort of that, you know, she did everything she could to help us feel proud of it. So I feel like now it's full circle. I'm doing that in a sort of way, the way that she did.
Kind of in a big way. So you incubated your bakery.
Yeah.
Oh, it with La Cucina.
Yeah.
Cucina. I mangle every word given to me that's you know, more than four letters. But tell me what that was like. You had been a community organizer before for 10 years. I mean, that is an enormous commitment to a certain kind of work. And then you switched to join the world of food. What was the connection between those two things?
Well, I think I was really fortunate to meet a place like La Cucina, to be connected to a place like La Cucina, because So for folks who don't know La Cocina, they are their mission is really to maintain the sort of cultural and economic vibrancy of San Francisco that is being lost, right, to sort of forces of gentrification. And it's harder and harder for communities of color, and particularly immigrant communities, to stay in San Francisco. And so they were really created because they saw there was this like real vibrancy of women doing food and sort of this sort of, I don't know what you call it, like a market,
an opportunity.
An informalized market, right? Mm-hmm. And so their mission was really to help formalize them so that they could actually make a living out of it and be able to sustain a family and live in San Francisco. And they were sort of the intersection of food and community and social justice. And, you know, for me personally, sort of a vehicle for me to really think about how could my food not just be a source of healing for me personally, but a healing for my community? Like, I didn't know how to put those things together until I joined that program. And I realized, you know, in order to be able to do that, I need to dream big. I need to scale. I need to think about what is the benefit of my business, not just this like cute bakery that, you know, provides good food, but actually provides good jobs, provides opportunities for my neighbors, really fulfills that sort of mission. Because I think when I made a decision to stop being an organizer professionally, I lost a piece of my identity. Like, it was a really hard shift
that
for me.
That is hard. And why did you choose to, because you gave that up rather than it being taken from you, I think.
Honestly, I burnt out, you know, like I think that is really,
it's real. Burnout is real.
Yeah. Burnout is real. In the nonprofit world, I was tired of, you know, sort of investing in campaigns, and then the funders would say, okay, you have to go this direction, and we would run in this direction. And, you know, and in the meanwhile, you're working with communities, and I wanted to build deeper. I didn't want to just kind of surface level. And I felt like I wasn't being able to do that meaningful work in sort of a nonprofit setting. So that's really, you know, why it's funny, because ironically, after I left the nonprofit world, I was making less and less and working more and more. Yeah. So, but, you know, I was building something for the long haul. And that's really what I think about when I think about Reams, is like Reams is not just the bakery. You know, it's really sort of what spawns off. Diafa is one thing, you know, hopefully sort of our wholesale that creates more jobs is another thing, and so on and so forth. I have this dream of, you know, building a farm that would, you know, employ refugee communities that are coming from rural backgrounds. So it's really this sort of bigger vision that I have that serves different functions.
Is that vision something that you had to cultivate? I mean, that notion, I'm just interested in the notion of losing a piece of yourself and how you found it again. Like, what were the tools and how did you sort of approach that situation? Because I think that there are a lot of people who, you know, they want to switch from one thing to the next. They are burned out or they need a different opportunity and they don't exactly know how to identify or find it. And how did you go through that process?
I mean, I think that I wanted to go really fast. I mean, I've moved relatively fast. I'm going to say, like, I feel very blessed. I've, like, been really lucky to kind of do, you know, I hustled for a long period of time and then sort of, but I think one of the things that I really appreciate about being part of the La Cocina program is that they slowed me down a little bit. And I actually took my time for 2 years.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, so I was ready to start. I joined the program in 2014. I was like, I want to do this and I want to do that. And they were like, you're going to slow down. And I didn't even formalize until 2015. I spent a year really cultivating my vision and my values and my mission. And that really, and I worked with volunteers who are doing brand development and all these things. And I worked really hard to figure out, to get solid on what my mission, vision, and values were. And that really became sort of the thing that was like, oh, I'm an organizer at heart. Food is going to be my vehicle. And so that became the sort of lens through which I made all my business decisions. And that made it really easy for me to figure out sort of the next direction of my business.
But La Cocina only incubates food businesses, or they incubate other things as well?
No, food businesses. Only, yeah. But like really for me, I was a mission based, like I was a social mission based like food business. It was very obvious to them. And so helping me sort of cultivate that piece of my, what makes what, you know, there are a lot of sort of Middle Eastern restaurants, and what distinguishes me from the others is that, you know, like my social mission is really that piece of the work that distinguishes me from the rest. So,
although I think just in everything that you know, I've read and observed, not having visited in Oakland, is the food itself is quite differentiated as well.
The food, yes, for
right.
Sure.
I mean, there's it is such a talking about moments, which I'm sort of over the notion of trend and moment, but it's been such a Middle Eastern moment.
Yes,
and it has, you know, everything sort of broad brushed with a hummus brush. You know, it's like everything's just
That's
hummus
a good
and
analogy.
Falafel.
I like it. Yeah, and we're beyond the hummus and falafel.
You really,
although ironically, we started serving falafel at Reims because the people have spoken, but.
The people just know what they know. I mean, this is something that I, you know, I've in editorial, the notion is you want to make people happy, but you also want to open their minds.
Yes.
And it's the same thing at the bakery, like you or your restaurants, because now there's multiples. But, you know, if they want hummus, that's great. But
we have that and we have this.
And you have this. You have the other options. And technically, as a cook, are you a great cook?
I would say I'm a baker first and foremost. Uh-huh. Bread is sort of my specialty. But yeah, I mean, I think that I learned, you know, I think I, thanks to my mom being a working mom, I had to learn how to be the cook in the family. And so we always sort of grew up. But when I knew I was going to be in the culinary world, I built those technical skills. La Cocina really helped, was integral in that piece of the work, because I was technically, you know, I'd worked in some of the, you know, Arismendi Bakery and Pizzeria, which is a really well-known and established, you know, like I got a lot of formative experience in the technical skills of baking, but not so much the cooking. And so I did a lot of externships with really great chefs, like Tracy Desjardins was a good mentor, like all these amazing chefs that were in the La Cocina sphere that I was lucky enough to sort of be mentored by, to build some of those technical skills. And yeah, I don't know.
It's so much
weird to say I'm a good chef.
Well, it's just interesting to do so many things at once, right? Because you have to build the business plan, but you also have to build the cooking skills.
Yeah, I had to learn everything.
You know, it's like a lot to take on.
And you have to learn how to scale. You know, it's not just like I'm not a home cook. Like, you know,
yeah, you have to do production.
And yeah, so
and then you have to teach people.
And you have to teach people.
And then you have to run a business. I mean, it's.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that I really enjoy about being a business owner is the work kind of related to the work I did in organizing, which is the leadership development piece. So I really love mentoring people. I love teaching them. I love watching, like, the first person who ever worked at my first farmer's market is now my director of operations. You know, like, I love cultivating people. And so if I could be the Arab Alice Waters, I love that. You know, my lead line cook is now starting his own sandwich shop in, you know, the peninsula. So, like, I love that piece of the work, is, you know, not so much managing people, but cultivating people. And so I want my places to be that place of cultivation.
So I always like to know who it is that, you know, so you're cultivating people, but is there someone who cultivated you, or is there someone who, a woman in hospitality, who inspires you every day, and who would that be and why?
Ooh, that's a good question. Oh my God, there's so many. I mean, I think about some of the badass women chefs who are working in Oakland, like Dominica Rice and Tanya Holland and Preeti Mistry. Like, I mean, all of those women, I like look up to them because I'm newer, you know, and they've like taken me under their wing. And I think, you know, but also some of the women at La Cocina were like chef de cuisines in other places, like Emiliana Payana and
You have to pick
Tracy
one.
Tracy Desjardins. I know, I can't. I can't really pinpoint one. I feel like all of those women have really inspired me.
So it's more like a women's web.
Yes. That. Yeah. We all have to support one another. So, yeah, it would be really hard to pick one of them.
Maybe the Oakland community of women chefs.
Yes.
If I was going to narrow it down for you.
Yes.
Because that is an extraordinary group of women that you just mentioned.
Yes.
And I think with that, our time is sadly up. I'm so excited to have gotten to talk to you after, you know, following you. I wanted to thank Travel Portland, Stream PDX, and the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage of Feast possible. And I wanted to thank Aaron Parecki, the co-founder of Stream PDX, for being our sound engineer today. Thanks, Stream. Thanks for joining
me. Thank you for having me.